G'day mate, how you going? This is Adam O'Brien and welcome to Fandom Podcast Network, here where we enjoy all forms of fandom. Well, coming to you live from Quinlan's Cantina in the Gold Coast of Australia, I bring you Lethal Mullet Podcast, an Australian look at B-grade action films from the 1980s. That's right, going back to that beloved time when we had Chuck Norris on almost every Friday night here in Australia, kicking, punching, and shooting his way to the top, alongside Jean-Claude Van Damme, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and the likes of many of the others that came after him. Sylvester Stallone. We even look at some of the heroes you may not know, all here on one Fortnightly podcast here on the Fandom Podcast Network. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can check it out also on Podbean if you've got the Podbean app. Make sure you check it out. Now, let's get into the episode here on Fandom Podcast Network. G'day mate, how you going? Welcome to the one, the only Lethal Mullet Podcast, live here from Quinlan's Cantina in the Gold Coast of Australia. That's right, Hollywood on the Gold Coast with mullets. That's right, with the big hair, and that's it, right, because it's business in the top and party in the back. And I'm your host, Adam O'Brien, and joining me tonight is the host of Type 40 Podcast, which is, of course, a Doctor Who podcast, and one of my dear pals when it comes to fandom, the one, the only, Dan Hadley. Buddy, how are you?
Hello, Adam. Would you like a jelly baby now or later? I'll just bring them wherever I go.
Let's have one now.
There you go. Yeah, help yourself. I have a whole bag. Yeah, I've got some more back
on. I tell you what.
It's great to be here. I've heard the show several times. Can't wait to get started. Not quite sure what you're going to do to me, but hey, that's all part of the fun too, isn't it?
Let's do it. Let's throw them under the bus. The co-owners of this here channel, the ones, the only, Carl Wagner and Kevin the Reader Nerd Ratzel. These two go in with all these luscious long scripts of, right, now, here's what we're going to do next. Well, guess what? We ain't doing that tonight. We're going to do whatever we feel like. That's right. That's half the fun of Lethal Mullet, is you don't know what's going to happen next. But, of course, we're going to be chatting some great stuff tonight. If you're a Terry Gilliam fan, we're going to be looking at the amazing Opus, a children's movie with a dark edge. The one, the only, Time Bandits. And, of course, that led to the other in the trilogy of imagination, Brazil and The Adventures of Baron Munchausen. Of course, those are very, very different films, but all under the same umbrella. But we're going to be chatting a little bit of other films and other projects. And also, we're going to be talking about some of the social networking that we're going to be seeing, of course, from Dan himself with Spacebook and beyond. So, pal, tell us a little bit about yourself. Obviously, you're a Doctor Who fan, but what else are you a fan of from back in the day?
From back in the day, good God. You know, it could be a lot easier to give you a list of things I'm not a fan of. It really, it really is quite nauseating. But yeah, I mean, the thing is, I'm a lifelong fan of science fiction, fantasy, and generally geeky entertainment, both at, in movies and TV, but in comic books in particular. And from time to time, I read normal books if I absolutely have to. All that sort of thing. But I think I've been geeking out since the term geeking out was around. And Doctor Who was very much the entry-level drug for me, you know, from the mid-70s onwards. It opened up this whole world to me, which really got really increased during the 1980s and the time of the mullet.
Oh, true. Now, I've got to ask, I mean, it's been around for so long. I mean, 40-plus years, Doctor Who's just one of the old dogs, if you like, in science fiction, you know, and it's one of the greatest when it comes from, of course, the British science fiction is so rich even out here. We've got that. We've got also Red Dwarf and Hitchhiker's Guide, which, of course, thanks to Doctor Who, we got that series, you know, through one of the writers.
Largely, of
some great work, like Shatter. That's right. It just sound good in the Australian, doesn't it? Shatter. You know, it'd be great, but I've always
keep working on it, yeah.
What I love about it is the fact that it's so universal as well. I mean, it's such a rich franchise.
Yeah, it is, and it's even though it's distinctly British, mm-hmm. which I know appeals really appeals to Australians. But it's distinctly British, but it's oddly multicultural as well. Mm-hmm. And it's a mixing pot of genres, in a sense. So I always say that Doctor Who isn't science fiction, Doctor Who is fantasy, of which part of that fantasy is science fiction, just as much as another part is, say, action-adventure or comedy. Yeah, it's got a light whimsy to it. Mm. And, you know, so it's very much a sort of melting pot of a lot of culty themes and ideas and pockets of fiction. Mm. Children's, mostly from children's fiction, but yeah, and that's why it can. That's how you see Doctor Who doesn't rip anything off. It merely homages, and Doctor Who fans will use that as a get out all the time. It never rips anything off.
You know, it's interesting. It really is. I think it riffs off other things that it sees. I mean, any good film or franchise does. Star Wars riffs off medieval stuff. Also, the likes of, you know, Japanese Jidai Geki films, the period dramas with the samurai, etc. You know, even you look at the likes of Sergio Leone riffed off Yojimbo, which Yojimbo was a riff off of an American one, which was called Red Harvest, a story in the West. So it's funny how that can obviously be like a mirror or a clone of it, but at the same time, an homage is always respectful. But with Doctor Who, what I found was that because there's so many different Doctors that we've had all the way through the years, is that, especially for us growing up in different generations, we've all had our little in, if you like, our door into this franchise. And that's a great thing. I think the only other series that is like that was in the 90s when I was in high school with Red Dwarf. You know, it was already running, and then I got it on series 2 or 3, I think it was.
A prime example, yeah. Red Dwarf has that, obviously, by virtue of starting out as a traditional sitcom that just happened to be set in space, and then opening up to become this sort of wry look at sci-fi and fantasy tropes, you know, things like the like time travel or the backwards planet or parallel universes and artificial intelligences, all those things. And you know, when you talk about Star Wars and the influences there, I think that although sometimes it's more broad than others, you know, Star Wars is, in many respects, it's a fairy tale set in outer space, and long may it be so. I always say that none of these things that we love so much, we can be as precious about them as we like, and we can analyse them as much as we wish and try to define them, but they're still created by other human beings just like us. This stuff wasn't sent down to us in scripture, and none of it happens and is created in a bubble. It's all got these other influences bearing on it from the either parallel, what's going on parallel in popular culture, or what happened in the past. George Lucas, a prime example, wanted to make a war story in many respects. Wanted to channel the trappings of those Japanese movies, and wanted to make Flash Gordon, which he loved so much as a kid. and you know, who can knock? You can't knock that. I mean, it's not that he didn't bring anything new to the equation. Of course he did. And now, unarguably, Star Wars, regardless of where Star Wars is right now, Star Wars, the classic trilogy, is Flash Gordon is kind of a footnote to that, really, in a strange way. But you know, just goes to show how popular culture expands and rolls on, and just how much fun it is if you're willing to sort of, you know, I'm not saying you can't think deeply about it, but just, you know, stop stroking your chin for a moment, grow the bullet, rock out and have some fun with it all. And I don't say the expression rock out very often because I can't get away with it. I know it, but I'm going to say it again. Rock out.
That's it. But I mean, if you do want to stroke your chin and get really deep, I mean, you can be really nitpicky. I mean, we've got fans out there that are, and let's just face it, we want George to own up to one thing because he's never really done it. He's been a huge reader of this book, and he always, you know, no, Star Wars ain't got nothing to do with that. No. And of course, we're talking Frank Herbert's Dune. Now, let's face it, George, you ripped it off. You did. Come on, buddy. You ripped off Dune. I mean, you've got a sand planet for starters, Tatooine. You've also got let's just say, moisture evaporators. What were the Fremen doing with you know, all their plants and stuff like that, and tubes to grab moisture evaporators. You've got those huge dragons in the pits and stuff like that. They're sandworms. I mean, look at the pit of Carcoon. That's a sandworm, for crying out loud. George, oh, yeah, it's got nothing to do with Dune. No.
Well, excuse me, I don't know. What year was Dune first published?
1965.
Ah, oh, God, earlier than I expected. Oh, the more I think about it, yeah, you might be...
Now, he continued to rip it off. That's right. Now, and I'm just coming up with this as a bit of an example of how nitpicky he can be. I don't actually feel this way, folks. But here we go. I'm going to give you my little spiel on it. He continued to rip it off in 1981 when he was creating Return of the Jedi with Jabba the Hutt, this huge long slug, which, of course, there was a giant sandworm man in God Emperor of Dune, Leto the Second, the Emperor, and he was on a big sled. Ah! There you go.
Oh, is that right? See, I never got that far with the books. I read the first two when I was about 11 years old, and my brain nearly turned to jelly. There was that much information
in them. It's a lot in it.
Expanded my mind, and I'm not sure I ever got it back.
I mean, you get even further nitpicky, and you've got the Bene Gesserit, which have the martial art of the Prana Bindu, which, of course, George went, yeah, I've just come up with this martial art for the Jedi, and I'm going to call them Jedi Bindu. So there you go.
It's going to be very interesting when these new films come out in over the next 2 or 3 years.
Oh, yeah, it's going to be huge. Now, of course, one of the things we need to do is let you folks at home know where to find myself, the Lethal Mullet, and, of course, Dan Hadley, and, of course, Phantom Podcast. Now, folks, you can catch all those big details towards the end of the podcast with a huge promo by Kevin Reed and Nerd Rat. So that's right, folks. You can catch me then. Well, it tells you all about it. But right now, we're going to tell you how you can catch up with Phantom Podcast Network. So you can subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher Radio. You can also find it on any place where good podcasts can be found, on podcatchers, etc. You can also get it on the Podbean app. Now, the Podbean app's probably the best one to do because you can catch all of our amazing channel there. And if you subscribe to it, all the new ones come fresh on there. Type 40 is one of those. Where can they find you, Dan?
Well, mostly on the Fandom Podcast Network in that Type 40 Doctor Who show. And there's a related Facebook group as well, which if you go to the search field and type 40 Doctor Who Fandom Group, you'll find that, where there's well over 700, close to 800 now, members, all talking about Doctor Who, past, present and future. So there's there. I post on Instagram as Dan Hadley, _, sometimes geeky, sometimes real life, sometimes 1 foot in each of those things. And I talk a lot of science fiction and fantasy and cult entertainment generally in a Facebook group called the Spacebook, which is again very similar to the Type 41, just full of people geeking out about whatever they like in print on the big and small screen.
One small step for man, one giant leap for geeky kind. That's right. Go and check it out.
Exactly.
And you can catch me, the Lethal Mullet, on Instagram and Twitter at The Lethal Mullet. How cool is that? And you can also catch me on Facebook on the page at The Lethal Mullet. So nice and easy, you can catch it there. But also, you can catch me on Fandom Podcast Network, where I carry my mullet over to there with Mark Newbold and the friends of the Fanta from Down Under. If you want to hear me chat about Star Wars and whinge about how there's not enough mullets in Star Wars, well, you can find it there at fantatracks.com. And, of course, Brian Cameron, our good Scottish lad, man, how you doing? He's got himself a Fantatracks app where you can get all the updates on all those too. So go and check it out. The lads all the way there. And, of course, our good pal Mark in Birmingham. There we are.
Yeah, I've been speaking to Mark lately. Good man.
He is. Now, I've got to say, while we're on a bit of a Doctor Who trek here, I'm going to talk about my favourite Doctor, and of course that's Mr. Baker. He wasn't my original love of when it comes to Doctors, but thanks to a man by the name of Hadley, this fella, I tell you what, he's done it. He's made me a sucker for Baker. I love it, man. There's something about Baker. He's big, burly lad. He's the Michael Caine from Get Carter of Doctors, mate. He's ready to knock out TARDIS to where he needs to go, get the job done and go home. He's the blue collar Doctor. I love it. I love the outfit. He's almost got a mullet going with the curls.
It gets there for a couple of years. It's definitely on its way there, isn't it? Yeah.
Oh yeah.
So you've really come round to the Tom Baker era, sort of.
It's it. It's the one. Baker is the man. Honestly, if you're going to put him on the big screen, the equivalent is Michael Caine. There's no mucking around. Like, big burly lad, not going to take any crap. And he'll knock out people in his way. He's just the attitude. He's kind of like a Sherlock Holmes, but he's got that at the same time that impetus to just get on with the job.
Do you think it's because, as well, what appeals to you with your sensibility and your comics sensibility with the hitchhikers and things is the fact that he can do that 1 minute and then he can switch just as quickly to comedy, to being impish, and to be the student rebellious kind of figure.
I think so.
Tom Baker and Douglas Adams got on famously in real life as well as in a professional relationship. And I think you can probably, you're picking up on that. Even before Douglas Adams was working on Doctor Who, you could see that starting to appear in Tom Baker's personality. He's a natural eccentric.
Oh, yeah.
And that does seem to be something that appeals to you.
Oh, without a doubt. And I think the thing is too, by the way, folks, somebody had an Arthur Dent moment this morning. Not me, but somebody. Let's just say that. I wonder who.
Oh, was that me?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was down on the building site yesterday, posted the picture up for Adam. Adam saw it, on my Instagram. That's the kind of quality you get on my Instagram page. Don't have the double up the score. Building sites.
Building sites, that's right. I'm just waiting for, excuse me, you can't put a hyperspace lane right through this way. Just waiting
well,
for
I was.
It.
To get that photo, I got a previous ones, which were taken through through a fence.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, this can't be, this is no good.
Yeah.
So I climbed up on the fence and sort of down the other side. I thought, well, you know, this is the Tom Baker, this is the doctor in me. what are they going to say if anybody asks? It's my land, I own it, I'm a VIP, I've been here for hours. That's how I tend to approach life. Don't worry about it until people ask, and then just give them any old story. Flash in the psychic paper.
I love it. Even when you think Arthur Dent, it kind of, especially from the TV show itself, there's echoes of Baker in just the outfit too. Just with the, you know, the obviously the long johns and the you know, that sort of look, I think is very Baker.
Yeah, and in the hopefully in the near future, we'll be talking some more about Douglas Adams, Doctor Who, and hitchhikers and all that sort of stuff over on Type 40 with you at a later date for an extended chat, I hope.
Yeah, definitely, folks. Stay tuned for that, because we're definitely going to be doing that over on Type 40 and get into just how that came about from, obviously, Douglas Adams working with the BBC on that and then moving into his own with, obviously, the radio dramas, which were just still to this day. I mean, I listen to them once every couple of months, just listen to all the way through, and they are something to behold. They're better than the TV show. They're better than that movie that came out. But they're still the be-all and end-all, even though the books are pretty good too.
Yeah, I think there's a version of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy for everybody. And Douglas Adams' mind, I mean, okay, it's the same core story. It hits a lot of the same beats with a lot of the same lines. But he understood so much about multimedia before there was a multimedia, really.
Yeah.
And I think he understood the way the human brain relates to story and what amuses us and how flexible these things can be, how they can be, that really to reinvent something. And it's not really rocket science. It's that people labour. I mean, he laboured over the Hitchhiker's movie script, didn't he, for about 15 years. But generally, you know, he suffered with writer's block and everything, I know, so I'm not trying to be flippant about that. But that generally, most things, if you're open and listen to the people who conceived them in the first place and what they were really about and what they were really trying to say, and most importantly of all, who they were for, and most of that material, it was for everybody, just the same as the film we're going to talk about later, it was very much for everybody. I think if you listen to that, then you can't really go far, far wrong, really. Mm. Listening to, for example, pressure groups, or trying very expressly to evolve something to fit with current sensibilities. Sometimes maybe coming from the right place, but it can often throw the baby out with the bathwater. And I think Douglas Adams resisted that. I think the Pythons have always resisted that. Terry Gilliam's always resisted that. So I think it's no coincidence that they all rose to their creative plateau in the mid to late 70s off the back of various things they'd all been doing in the preceding 10 years.
Oh, without a doubt. And I think that's the thing is, as we lead up to, obviously, what we're going to be talking about tonight, let's give you guys a little bit of a rundown of just, you know, how that all came about. Obviously, we've got some great talent behind this picture that we're going to be chatting about. Terry Gilliam, Michael Palin, obviously writing it. But when you get down to it, it came from a time where we had, I think, not just a lot of adult entertainment. 70s was a dark time for entertainment. I think there was very serious crime dramas and lots of, the end of the world sort of goings on that was in films before we had the likes of Star Wars come along to sort of lighten the load. But I think British television kept us going. We had, obviously, Monty Python through the 70s, but we also had The Goodies with Tim Brooke Taylor, Graham Garden, and, of course, Bill Oddie. And I think that sort of group that came out of, you know, the likes of Cambridge University at the time, and this is where we get people like Graham Chapman, John Cleese, Eric Idle, obviously Monty Python. But I think, you know, kudos to these guys. Bill Oddie and Tim Brooke Taylor and Graham Garden were just as nuts.
They were contemporaries, weren't they? And they were, in fact, there's a bit of a crossover. I think, I can't remember which ones. I think it could be Tim Brooke Taylor, certainly Graham Garden. They were at university with some of the same people and appeared on some of the same TV shows early in their career. A show called Last the 1948 Show ITV.
Yep. And it's crazy because at the end of the day, these are the guys that, you know, as we went into, I suppose, the mid-80s after a lot of those shows finished up, we saw them doing very, very similar things, but trying to do it by themselves sometimes. I remember seeing something Bill Oddie was doing at one stage there too, which is echoing even Python at a stand-up gig. So you can see that the seeds of a lot of these great projects, like Time Bandits, came from the sketches that they did back here.
That's unquestionable. And I think that, you've got a very sort of clear line, haven't you, between Terry Gilliam's first film, Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Yes.
First film as a director, which although does have a narrative to it. He does, as the film rolls along, the walls to it are sort of breaking down. And Gilliam, and the cast, to be fair, all the Pythons, sort of pull at it from the inside, don't they? They encourage those walls to give in and for the rest of reality to sort of encroach into the movie itself. And I think there was Jabberwocky 2 or 3 years later, was along similar lines, but probably a little straighter. Maybe he's trying to behave himself. I don't know. It's a very playful film though, but not on anywhere near the same level as Time Bandits in 1981, where it connects back, as you say, to that sort of sketch comedy mentality that was that Monty Python did so much to expand and to create, to play with and to break down boundaries and to weave in and out within each half-hour show.
Oh, 100%. I mean, you only have to do a search on YouTube right now and you'll find the French Night sketch is everywhere where they've had mix and matches up. You know, particularly the scene where he goes, "Excuse me there, kind sir. I have a search. I need to search for the Grail." And he goes, "Oh, it's okay. I already got one." You know, like in his, "Hey, I told him we already got one." It's just a classic line that they play up with, you know.
Were they? This is it. I mean, for all the ridiculousness of it, there's an ear for the way that people really speak, and they may. I know they played virtually all of the female characters themselves in Flying Circus and the films, and that does sort of carry through throughout their careers. But the things that they say, it's done with affection. It's not there to be cruel in any way. It's fondness, maybe I'm not an expert on Python or any of those sorts of things, but I get the impression that just like the Beatles films and the Magical Mystery Tour and all that sort of thing, that these were people that they the voices were people that they knew in their day-to-day life growing up, the members of their extended family or friends or neighbours and things. And that carries through. I think it's present right the way through the careers of most of the pythons, no matter in what direction they went.
Oh, yeah.
And the same with Bill Oddie. He's a wonderful eccentric. Bill Oddie grew up about half a mile from where I'm sat now speaking this. He went to the same school as my sons, in fact.
Oh, wow.
He's a Hales Owen guy. And he's all the things he's done, you know, a lot of which have been as Bill Oddie. You know, the guy is clearly a very natural eccentric and belonging of the same world. I mean, I've never met him. I've quite liked it. I suspect a 10-minute conversation with Bill Oddie would not be what you'd expect.
No, exactly. I mean, the thing is, I find a lot of these comedians, and even the likes of Terry Gilliam, I mean, Terry's probably from what I've seen of conversations with Terry, he's probably the most eccentric out of all of them, but the most likable. Whereas, you know, you see conversations with Michael Palin or John Cleese. These are very literate people. People that are, you know, obviously, you know, they've been to Cambridge. They've been to a lot of these universities. They've got degrees. And, you know, comedy's not their natural thing. Their natural thing is to be basically scientists, basically.
Yeah, I think they're quite middle-class people, generally. You know, the British are obsessed with class, as you probably know.
Yeah.
You know, still the case. And they are quite middle-class people, but I think they're very aware of it. Mm. And they needed somebody like Terry Gilliam and to a slightly lesser extent, Michael Palin. I think they were the two, if there's roguish elements within the Pythons, it's those two. And I think it's quite telling that I think Michael Palin is the co-writer. I think I saw it on the credits. I watched this film again less than 48 hours ago. And I think Michael Palin co-wrote this with Terry Gilliam.
Yeah.
Probably because they were very natural, creative bedfellows. You know, because there's little pockets within the Pythons, isn't there? And they all worked with one another in various different things.
Oh yeah, definitely.
For different mediums.
Yeah, I think that's where they've sort of gone. I mean, particularly with Terry. Terry obviously coincided with Terry Jones quite a bit with, especially with Holy Grail, and obviously onto, you know, The Life of Brian, etc. But one of the interesting things is the career he's had outside of Python, going obviously with Time Bandits, Brazil, Munchausen, and then he, of course, does The Fisher King in 91 and pretty much puts him on the map as far as, like, not just a director to come, but a director with some real voice to his own, and working with Robin Williams in probably arguably his best movie.
I'd say it's up there. Yeah, it's a beautiful film in many respects, The Fisher King, and a lot of the imagery that we see in that. In fact, I think that could be the pinnacle of Gilliam's films, looking back. I think a lot of the visuals in that, when I watched Time Bandits this time, The Fisher King, it really reminded me of it, particularly any time that horse sort of reared up on its back legs with the camera directly underneath.
But I also liked, in 95, he did with Brad Pitt and Bruce Willis and Madeleine Stowe, 12 Monkeys, which I don't think gets enough love. That's a film that's very... you know, artistic, but at the same time, very, very interesting in the way that it's sort of not your contemporary science fiction film.
No, that was a remake as well, wasn't it? Originally a French film, I think it had been made before.
Yeah, I think so. I think it was some type of French film or at least a short film. And he took, the screenwriter at the time took that idea and ran with it. But, Terry's definitely put his stamp on that, especially the science fiction scenes in the future. The scenes, those alone, are very Python in design, without a doubt.
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, that carries on. I mean, certainly right through until... I haven't seen the last couple of Gilliam films, but that aesthetic carries on right the way through. I mean, so much... I think it's the choice of fabrics, the way everything is sort of gathered, where it's gathered, has that. It has this sort of music hall sensibility and a bohemian feel to it. Funnily enough, I mean, that was another thing I noticed. I'm sorry, guys. I can never go for more than 10 minutes without mentioning Doctor Who. So here
we go. Shatter! Shatter!
I was looking on the end credits, and I noticed that the costume designer was Jim Acheson.
Oh, wow.
He's the guy. He was on Doctor Who for several years, worked on several series, several seasons worth, and notable stories, but his probably biggest contribution was that he designed Tom Baker's classic original outfit.
Oh, wow.
With a knitted waistcoat and the sort of flecked trousers with the shorter jacket and the floppy hat and, crucially, the long scarf, which Acheson didn't intend on it being quite as long as it actually was. That happened afterwards when it got taken to an old lady to have been knitted up all this wool.
Oh,
but the general
wow.
principle is the same. And you get that in these costumes too. Jim Acheson went on to be, I think he may have even won an Academy Award for his production design on movies. But he the last things he worked on, he's worked with everybody basically.
Yeah.
Sam Raimi's Spider-Man movies, you know, he designed Spider-Man's costume for those films and everything else that came with that. So this is a guy who, you know, started just like Douglas Adams. He started with the BBC,
nice.
Moved on and expanded and into movies.
Oh, that's amazing. I love it. I love it when you obviously see a progression and they've had such a good foundry with something like the BBC, which gives everyone, you know, a chance to really work their skills and really push it out there. I think that's something that's great and brings to me the big throwdown before we hit to Time Bandits. And we're going to do Hot 10 very, very soon. So it'll be your chance to chat about, or we could leave it till the end, give you a bit of a warm-up till we get there. That might be the way to do it. Top 10, your Hot 10 questions about the 1980s. And, of course, they're all very general. But here's my throwdown. Doctor Who, the reboot, needs to be a movie, not a TV show. It needs two people. I hope you're ready. Here we go. Director, Tim Burton. The Doctor, Johnny Depp.
Funny enough, there was talk about that. That's rolled around several times. And I know that Tim Burton is, say, a Doctor Who fan. So who knows, it may. That may happen one day. I can see Tim Burton working on Doctor Who in some capacity or another in time. I'd love to see Johnny Depp in there. I know he's slightly busy at the moment, but...
he is.
Yeah. I'd love to see that. I think he's falling a little bit out of favour after one too many Pirates of the Caribbean movies.
Oh,
but again, he's a natural eccentric, though.
He is.
And more importantly than that, he's a great actor, Johnny Depp. I think it's easy to take Johnny Depp for granted when he's in so many movies. Very, very prolific. But now we shouldn't forget that Johnny Depp's a fantastic actor.
Oh, he's just brilliant. Now, folks, we're going to be heading into chatting now about Time Bandits, and with the... is obviously one of the most quintessential British fantasy films ever made, along with Excalibur and, dare I say, Krull as well. I think those three films are the cornerstone of the 80s fantasy genre. You can argue that Willow's just as good, but I don't think so. I think as we've seen, Willow doesn't have quite the breadth of imagination that these films have. And Terry Gilliam really brings it to the fore with a cast of people like Sean Connery, John Cleese, Shelley Duvall from The Shining, Ralph Richardson, Catherine Hellman, Ian Holm. That's right, you get a hobbit in this one. Michael Palin, Peter Vaughan, and, yeah, that's right, the bad guy from Tron, David Warner. I mean, it's pretty impressive cast.
Extraordinary cast. And every time I see the film, I haven't seen Time Bandits for about 5 years until I watched it this time. And I always spot one or two people that I've not noticed before. Annoyingly, people from Doctor Who, of course. But people, just people who were mainstays of British television during the 1970s and the 1980s. This time there's David Dacre. Played Kevin's father in the mm-hmm. scenes at the beginning and in the very end of the film. He's an actor, not too far away from me. He's a Midlander.
Nice.
Very famous for a long running role in a detective show called Boom. And here he plays Kevin's horrible father.
In this film, yeah, it was interesting because this is really from Kevin's perspective. It's, again, about a kid's imagination, if you like. This is a film where you've got, obviously, The Trilogy of Imagination. The Trilogy of Imagination starts with this film in particular. So we've got the likes of this being told from a kid's perspective. Then we've also got, obviously, Brazil and Adventures of Baron Munchausen, which kind of wraps out this trilogy, where Brazil's told from an adult's perspective, but Munchausen's from an elderly man's perspective. So the three sort of phases in your life. That's interesting that he did that.
I had no idea about any of that. I mean, I could see the themes in Gilliam's work, mm-hmm. but I didn't know it was as conscious as it was. That's really interesting. And funny enough, I enjoyed Time Bandits so much that I did plan on going back to those other films. So I'll watch them with sort of fresh eyes now you've said that. No, I didn't know that.
It's just interesting to see sort of a different perspective. That I found out through a little bit of trivia. But, I mean, the crux of this film is we've got a kid with a vivid imagination, particularly for ancient Greece, is basically ignored by his parents completely and what activities he gets up to. And so he basically falls down into, let's just say, a time-traveling well. This is very much a Doctor Who style with a kid, pretty much. But we have six dwarves that spill out of the wardrobe and basically follow him through this. And some of those you're going to know quite well because one of them just happens to be R2-D2, Kenny Baker.
Yeah, delightful Kenny Baker. He doesn't say a great deal in this, but he was a great physical comedian, I think, Kenny Baker. I never actually met him per se, mm-hmm. but anybody who went to sci-fi conventions in the late 80s and through the 90s will have bumped into Kenny Baker because he was at all of them. And they used to be a lot less formal than they are now. So you could usually spend, you'd bump into him holding court. I mean, I was queuing up for the gents the once, mm-hmm. the toilets at the NEC. There was Kenny Baker, just the same as everybody else, queuing up for the toilet and chatting away to people. He portrays glee so well on his face. I think all of the Time Bandits themselves play off each other so well. And I know that they give them various names throughout it, but the fact that they are there sort of en masse and have their little personalities just sort of come through, don't they?
Oh, it does. It does. It very much so.
And that's the physical comedy.
It is.
More so than the script.
Oh, it really is. And I think that's the thing is, this film, as well as they're trying to obviously tell a story, it really plays to the idea of it's a kid's imagination, because the kids can't keep concentrating. We know that as being kids ourselves, or even watching our own kids, they can't hold concentration for too long. And I think that's what this film does. It's a bunch of select scenes from different parts of the world, from different times. And it just plays so well to the fact that maybe this is how the kid's taking that in. I don't know if that was a conscious decision by Terry Gilliam, but this is why we've got such great roles. Like, obviously, we've got Kevin in there as our eye into this. We've got Kenny Baker playing Fidget. But then we have Sean Connery playing Agamemnon in ancient Greece. Now, this was a surprise to me the first time I watched it.
Yeah, I think it was to me too. And still, whenever I watch it and he takes that helmet away, we see the character fighting, don't we, from the distance at first.
We do.
Going into battle. And it builds up to it until he's vanquished his enemy and he's sort of knackered and falling down. Mm-hmm. And then he removes the helmet and there's all this dust and spit and gravel everywhere, and there's the famous face of Sean Connery, who spent a few years sort of, I would say in the wilderness as such, but doing quite small-scale movies after the whole Bond celebrity and notoriety. So, yeah, it was a big thing, and 5 years before, what's termed as his sort of big comeback period with Highlander and The Untouchables, mm-hmm. This was a good five years before that. So it's a great cinematic moment, and he plays it. He enjoys it so much. You can see him relishing that part. And the idea that with a wink, literally with a wink, I'm sure he winks at least twice in the film.
He does, but I think the great thing about it, as much as he's playing to the audience that way, and it's something that Gilliam does. Now, this is, you look at it, it's a wacky story, it's a fantasy, but when he does characters, they're very realistic. When he does violence, he does it realistically, so you can see violence always has a consequence. There's always, for every action, there's a reaction.
True, yeah.
So Gilliam's all about that. He said, I'm not going to shy away and do like a kid's G-rated movie. This, or any production he does, if something happens, you're going to see the reaction, because at the end of the day, people need to learn why violence shouldn't happen and all that sort of stuff. But I think Sean Connery does it so grounded. You're seeing, especially that battle, it takes a big toll on him. I mean, he's, like you say, you said knackered. That's 100% what he is. He is literally tired by the end of it. And I think he's very at peace with this role. He doesn't have to be cool. And in a way, that makes him cooler as Agamemnon than Bond. You know, he's kind of like, yeah, this is my sword. Shank it very much. He's not doing any of that sort of Bondness. It's kind of like he's just cool with it. And I think that's a fantastic role.
It is. He's such a, physically, Sean Connery was, and probably even still is, in his mid to late 80s, very tall man,
yep.
Very tall, very broad, a classic hero. He's sort of a classic. If you were to ask a child of Kevin's age then, and probably even now, to draw a heroic-looking male, he would probably draw Sean Connery.
I think so, too. I don't think that's quintessential. Obviously, he plays the fireman later on, but also, we have, obviously, Dillinger from Tron, David Warner himself, in this as evil. So, basically, as the bad guy in this. But what I love about Warner in this is that he's so thin. He's just always been that tall, thin build. And he's got that really sort of, I suppose, the jaw to play an iconic villain, doesn't he?
Yeah. David Warner's a wonderful actor. No matter what part he's playing, he hasn't always played villains, but he has played a lot of great villains. And yeah, he's got the sort of the pointy nose and the pointy chin and a pointed way of speaking too. And I love the fact that they don't give him some sort of name like Skeletor or Emperor Dark or anything. It's just evil. That's all you need. That's all you need to know. It's another part of the charm of this film.
Mm-hmm.
That it does everything about this for such an abstract movie. the cornerstones there are very, very simply good and evil, and those mainstays of storytelling, I suppose you could say.
Oh, it is. And I think that's why we got such good performances out of all of this too. And it's the realism. You got Ian Holm as Napoleon in this. And as much as I love the Napoleon we see in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, which, you know, is going down water slides and going to Chuck E. Cheese and all that sort of stuff in the States. And it was great. I actually quite liked that role. It was really good. But the Napoleon we see in this, played by Ian Holm, I think is even better. It's quite a funny role.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, again, he's one of several actors in this. I'm thinking of my personal favourite is, I think it's Peter Vaughan, Peter Vaughan. He only died a couple of years ago. He was in Game of Thrones and mm-hmm. Porridge and all these other things as Winston the Ogre.
Yep.
The pair of them, like good British character actors you see in everything, who are just enjoying, they say about every single word of this mm-hmm. to sort of goof around and to be... And to be playful.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, we've also got Robin Hood, played by John Cleese. And classic John Cleese, it's brought down to very political and very maneuvering style of being a crook. You know, he's more a political crook as Robin Hood. Yeah. It's hilarious. It's really well done.
Yeah, I think with John Cleese, he never, I don't think I've ever seen him underplay anything really.
Mm-hmm.
And I would imagine that he had some influence on the sections that he was involved in, those script wise and things. But this version of Robin Hood, it's quite unlike any other that I've ever seen.
It's truly amazing. And I think that is, we've seen it played up by Mel Brooks, obviously, in Robin Hood Men in Tights and others. Yeah. But there's something a bit more real about this, which makes it the humour hit harder, I think.
Yeah, because it has it's unflinching.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? They're not mucking around with it. You know, it's they're not holding back, when you say. I think that's the great thing about it. And again, that's something that Monty Python always did. Yeah. Monty Python always did that, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. And on occasions, they were taken to task for it, but mm-hmm. and I don't think they ever apologise for any of the things any time they ever presented any material in any given way. And you know what? I love them for that. I respect them for that.
Oh, definitely. So the production itself was based on a screenplay that Michael Palin put together with Terry Gilliam. And it's interesting the fact that, you know, those two have continued, and even others continued to write together. You know, obviously Graham Chapman always used to work with John Cleese because they were very good mates as well. But interesting, too, that the film itself was only on a budget of $5 million, so about £2.2 million, but it grossed in the US $40 million. So it's quite successful.
You would never think of this as a cheap film.
No.
I think it still looks incredible.
Oh, it does. It holds up the test of time when you've got films like this, or even Highlander to some example. They use a lot of, I think, you know, less sets and more like literally location work. And I think that's what really holds up is just the beautiful photography. Gilliam's got a hell of an eye when it comes to shooting these films, doesn't he?
Yeah, and particularly the Greek sequences, wherever that is filmed, it reminded me of The Life of Brian, funnily enough.
Yeah.
You know, to find a location like that and to use it so well, it brings an authenticity. I mean, maybe if they had tried to have recreated that in a studio, maybe it would have looked as cheap as it actually is. You know, so maybe by thinking outside of the box like that, because of pressures, necessity becoming the mother of invention, has by default given this film that timeless quality.
Oh, it really does. And I think the thing is, this aimed at kids. I mean, I remember having the VHS years ago as a kid in the early 80s. And, you know, we got to a point where it's unwatchable because we just watched it so much it had worn out the actual tape itself. And I think that's the same as any of those video shops you went to. You picked it up, put it in. It was never rewound. Funny that.
Yeah, we all, yeah, until they started putting the stickers on that said, please rewind.
Be kind, rewind.
Or they started fining you for it. That was, yeah, I remember seeing this long before I saw the film. I was aware that there was a film called Time Bandits because they used to run in things like Look In magazine, which we had over here. It was like a magazine for young children. And in the Marvel Comics reprints that we got then and still get to this day, they used to run one-page ads for movies. And the Time Bandits one would appear quite regularly with the poster, mm-hmm. Which is sort of, I think there are several posters, but the one I'm thinking of is the line drawing. I think it was drawn by Terry Gilliam himself,
mm-hmm.
of the it's the scene from where the giant has got the ship on top of his head. And he's walking through the water, and in the middle distance there's some land, obviously at the water's edge, and a castle moving up into the sky. But the sky is a grid. It's like something Leonardo da Vinci would have drawn. The sky is a grid made up of the holes representing the various different holes that the time bandits drop in and out of during the film. And I remember seeing that poster at least 4 years before I got to see the film, and just being enchanted by it and wondering what earth it could be, how surreal it was. It wouldn't have looked out of place on a prog rock album in the 70s, would it? But that poster, I remember that poster, and eventually when the VHS market exploded in the UK,
mm-hmm.
to see the box sitting on the shelf, because that's when I first saw it. I rented it from a video shop based purely, I didn't know who the Pythons were, didn't know who Terry Gilliam was, had no idea who was in it. I rented it solely because I'd remembered that poster, that artwork.
Yeah. Oh, that's amazing, isn't it? And again, that's what we used to do with VHS, was that they had all these great poster art or anything like that was available. It was just so beautiful. And I think we've lost a lot of that with Photoshop, all these less chemical approaches, you know, because half the great things is with artwork, even when I was an artist in my 20s, you know, you make a mistake with gouache or oils, then that was it. The mistake was there. You had to work with it. It was part of the artwork. Now you just literally get rid of a layout. And we've lost a bit of that, I think.
Yeah. We've lost the soul. That's what I'm thinking.
We really have. We really have. Now, this film, this is interesting. This is off the... If you folks want to check it out, there's some great information on this film on Wikipedia, and you can obviously find it on Internet Movie Database as well. But I'm going to check out this book. It's called Monty Python, The Case Against Irreverence, Scurrility, Profanity, Vilification, and Licentious Abuse. And it looks like it's written by...
It's easy for you to say.
Yeah, well, that's a mouthful. I can tell you, I practiced it twice. and Robert Hewison describes the dwarfs in this movie, I'll try and get this right if I can, as basically representing the guys in Monty Python itself. It was based off them, if you like. The nice one, Fidget, is said to be Palin. The self-appointed leader, Randall, is Cleese. The acerbic one, Strutter, is Eric Idle. The quiet one, Og, is Graham Chapman. And the noisy rebel, Wally, is Terry Jones. And the nasty, filthy... filth-loving one is Gilliam himself. So it was sort of a representation, apparently, according to this book. So you find that quite obviously and all that sort of stuff on the Wikipedia page. Again, it's great to... We've got these sorts of technology now where we can find out more about the films, more about the intent of the directors, and thank goodness for anyone that's involved in getting all this together, because it's lovely to read.
So in a sense, as I was watching this, well, I was reminded so much of Monty Python's Flying Circus. In a sense, this is, apart from the with casting, this was a Monty Python film. This is the fourth Monty Python film.
It really is. It is. I mean, maybe they didn't want to work together anymore at the time. And I mean, really, at the end of the day, they are. I mean, that's, you know, apart from Graham Chapman and Terry Jones, the rest of them are involved in this. You know, they're all in there. But what's interesting is we've talked about this offline. Back on the 27th of July last year, Anonymous Content and Paramount gained the rights to Time Bandits to put on Apple TV as a show, basically. And it's going to be written and produced by Taika Waititi, and he'll be directing the pilot episode of this series. So very interesting to see what they do, because, I mean, literally, it'll be a time-traveling show, so they could do just about anything. Let's hope. I think that one of the great places to make this, as much as I'd love to see it made in the UK, I think it needs to be made in NZ. I think it needs to be made with the guys from Weta, and we really need to just let Taika go to town on it.
I think that could be incredible. I knew that there's been several projects to do with Time Bandits, probably over the last 20 years. I mean, for a long time, there was supposed to be a Time Bandits 2, again, directed by Terry Gilliam.
Yeah.
And that ideally starred a lot of the same people. And that died when David Rappaport, who played Randall, when he took his own life. I can't remember when that was, probably 20 years ago now. So all talk of Time Bandits 2 sort of died off then. In the interim, though, there have been several ideas about remaking it with any actor of restricted height. For whatever reason, sort of got attached to it. Peter Dinklage was rumored attached to a Time Bandits remake for a while, for example, which, you know, you could say is, you know, it was lazy thinking, probably by journalists. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But the project has never really gone away. And there was an animated series mooted for quite a while, in fact, that was, I think, something to do with Cosgrove Hall, who made Danger Mouse and Count Dracula and things like that.
Oh wow!
Which I think that was supposed to have been voiced by the original cast. I don't know how far along that project got developed, but yeah, the idea that this could be turned into a TV show, to a regular TV show, ideally for a family audience, I would hope, is incredible. The scope for it is it's never ending, isn't it? Really, it's like Doctor Who. It doesn't have to end, and. Taika Waititi, is that how you pronounce his name? As a creative, I can't think of anybody in the current creative sphere more qualified than him to go at this. I think it's perfectly in line with his sensibilities. I think it's the right time in his career where he could sort of bring the best of his work to a show like it. I find that very, very exciting.
Oh, without a doubt, without a doubt. So, folks, go and check out that film if you haven't already. You can find it on DVD. I think, pretty sure it's available on Blu-ray. And it's pretty regular on TV, free-to-air and vice versa, probably on digital as well. But, which leads us to our last little segment here tonight, which is the Hot 10, where we're going to go through some trivia and just see what Dan knows and what he doesn't know. But also, it also shows... what you can learn as well. So we're going to go take a thrust back to 80s action movies. And the first one we're going to talk about is Die Hard. Do you know who the original star was going to be for Die Hard?
Oh, I heard this not that long ago because Die Hard was originally going to be a sequel to something. Was it Arnold Schwarzenegger?
That's correct. Yep, 100%. It was Arnold Schwarzenegger. It was going to be Commando 2.
That's it. I knew it was supposed to be a sequel to something. Go on. I've already got one more right than I thought I would.
There you go. So far, 1 out of 10. Okay, second question. Who was originally going to be cast as Indiana Jones but had to pull out due to a TV show?
That was Tom Selleck.
Oh, God, he's doing well tonight, folks. There we are. Well done, yeah. Now, can you actually imagine him as the role? I look back on it now, I think he would have been a perfect fit for it.
I think he'd have been extraordinary in that part. And as much as I love Harrison Ford as Indiana Jones, I think Tom Selleck might have even been better. And I think that had he been allowed to take that role, you might not have got 7 years, however many, of Magnum. Sorry, Norm, if you're listening to this. But you would. I think we would have had, Tom Selleck would have had an amazing film career. I think he's a fantastic actor. Very, very overrated and underserved. I think fate wasn't very kind to Tom Selleck. He's wonderful.
No, definitely. Now, one of the big comedies of the 80s was 1984, a supernatural comedy, the one, the only. We came, we saw, we kicked it. You know what? That's right. It is Ghostbusters. Was originally going to have as its lead what actor?
Oh, I know that James Belushi was originally supposed to be in this, or John Belushi, sorry.
Mm-hmm, correct. But the main was actually Chevy Chase, believe it or not.
Oh, okay. No, I didn't know that.
But there's a rivalry between Bill Murray and Chevy Chase. And I think there was some stage that we're going to have both of them in the film. And he just said, nah, this isn't for me. I'm going to have to bail on this one. This just doesn't cut it. Cut the mustard. And I think
they've got a very similar sort of persona, hadn't they, in movies?
Well, they do. And I think that's the thing at the end of the day. It was a way to, bring people in one way or another. And I think... a lot of the people that were involved back then, it was all coming from Saturday Night Live, which we didn't get a lot of out here. Did you guys get in the UK?
No, not in the slightest. Not so much as a single series of it. It's never been shown in this country.
It's crazy, isn't it? Like, even what my most of Australian TV was BBC. It really was. And I think that's... the greatness of what we learnt, at the end of the day was all through that. And some people get it, some people do not. I think that's what's interesting about it, And now we're starting to see some of those shows now, I think, as we get digital TV and stuff like that. I think it's opened up the doors to all that sort of stuff.
Oh, absolutely.
That's right. So what American president was named after a laser? I bet you know this one. Oh, I bet you know this one.
Sure. But with TV, with entertainment and with movies, yeah, I think it's generally quite a good place.
It is. So what American president from the 1980s was named after a laser?
Well... what American president from the 1980s was named after a laser? Well, given the fact that there was only two presidents through the whole of the 1980s, we have to go by a process of elimination here, that is Ronald Reagan.
Ray Gunn, that's right.
Oh, God.
Got it. That's a trick one, wasn't it? But you got it. You still got it.
I can't believe I fell for that.
it's just one of those ones you got to do. Now, obviously, we had some great films in the 1980s, which would star the likes of Harrison Ford, James Earl Jones, and, of course, an array of other great actors. Some of these actors went off into the 90s joining other films together. Can you name when you saw Han Solo and Darth Vader together again in another film outside of Star Wars?
Well, that would have been Harrison Ford and James Earl Jones in Patriot Games or Clear and Present Danger, I would imagine.
110%. Got it. Nailed it. Yes. So they've been in quite a few films together when you think about it. It's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah. Didn't he play his sort of Jack Ryan's Superior.
He did, yeah, yeah, 100%. He was his superior in it. Mm. Yeah, so it was all part of, like, I suppose him teaching the ways and stuff like that too, about who was involved and stuff. I think one of the great things about that is that they got to know each other through those movies. So here's one for you. Matthew Broderick, what do you remember him from? What film in the 80s was his huge kickoff? Was it Beverly Hills Cop, St. Elmo's Fire, Election, The Breakfast Club, or Ferris Bueller's Day Off?
Well, the one, it's Ferris Bueller for me. I know that he'd had films before then, but it's Ferris Bueller, but
that's the one.
When I think of Broderick now, I still think of him lying down across the bonnet of that car with his back against the windshield and a pair of shades on, yeah.
That's the one, 100%. Now, can you name a movie which starred John Candy, Mel Brooks, and also Bill Pullman?
That was... Spaceballs.
100% Spaceballs, yes. That's the one.
So I've only ever seen once and couldn't stand. So, yeah, I'm amazed I can remember that. I'm going to give that one another look, though, because many of the members of my Facebook group on Facebook adore Spaceballs. So I promise them I'll go back and take another look faithfully.
Oh, you got to do that one. Now, can you name, we'll make this the last one, a film starring Dan Aykroyd and Dan Aykroyd. I don't know if this is played in the UK, so it'll be interesting to see the this one goes, where he plays Jekyll and Hyde, literally, as a doctor in New York.
Ooh, he plays a doctor in New York.
Oh, actually, no, I'll give you a hint. It's a doctor in the city of Detroit. There you go.
Oh, I was about to make a punt on that then. definitely set in New York. Detroit. I'm going to struggle with this.
I've literally given you the answer. It's in there.
I was going to go with Trading Places, but...
Wrong answer. It is actually Dr. Detroit.
No, I don't know that film at all. Maybe others do, but no. That's a new one to me. It's one to go and look up later on, get the old Wikipedia out. Yeah.
Just got to break it out and check it out. So, folks, I hope you've had a little bit of a rundown memory lane with us. And without a doubt, I think one of the best films Gilliam's ever done is this film. Obviously, we wouldn't have the films like 12 Monkeys and Munchausen and even right up to the Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus if it wasn't for these films. I mean, he's just one of those directors that just keeps going with his imagination and does not hold court of anyone else's opinion. Only his vision counts. And I think you'd be right up there with saying the same, wouldn't you, Dan?
Oh, definitely. I mean, like you mentioned Tim Burton earlier on. For me, it's in this oeuvre, in this little corner of directors, it's Tim Burton and Terry Gilliam, without a shadow of a doubt. You know, there are as many people out there that hate them as love them, but they'll all be able to recognise one of their films.
Oh, without a doubt. And I think that's the genius of it at the end of the day. It's what brings, you know, the world in, you know, is just that itself, you know. It's the fact that, you know, he creates such livable but also versatile worlds that we all just get caught up in the imagination of what he puts together. It's just beautiful.
Just get swept away.
You really do. So, folks, stay tuned. We're going to have a little promo very, very soon with Kevin the Radio Nerd Rats. I'll tell you about the one and only Fandom Podcast Network. I'm telling you, boys and girls, he's going to love it over there. And, of course...
When Kevin gets hold of you, you'll be in some trouble.
Oh, no. He knows I do this. You know, I could go even further and do Kyle a little bit down south. We got ourselves in a lovely place down in Florida. That's right. It's a nice little place on the coast there. You got to go and check out, obviously, their shows as well, folks. But, Dan, we're going to get, obviously, our listeners, get on Facebook. Get on, check out Spacebook. And obviously check out the Doctor Who page and get on XML 80's Blast page as well. And, mate, I tell you what, have some fun.
That's what it's all about. People make social media, and particularly Facebook and Twitter, people turn them into echo chambers and hell on earth. But it needn't be like that. There is another way. Follow the light. join the space book and join Blast with Adam and myself.
100%, buddy, 100%. So, folks, go and check it out. I want to thank Dan so much for being on the show tonight. And, folks, get on there, have a bit of a chat, have a bit of a chin wag, as we say out here in Australia, and enjoy your fandom. From Adam and Dan here at the one, the only Lethal Mother podcast, good afternoon, good evening, good night. We'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening. We hope you're enjoying this podcast. We'd like to recommend these other great podcasts on the Fandom Podcast Network. It starts with our flagship show, Culture Clash, our weekly pop culture podcast with the latest news, reviews, and other fun topics in pop culture. Also, Blood of Kings, a Highlander podcast where we discuss all things Highlander. Couch Potato Theater, our podcast celebrating the cult classic and fan favorite movies we don't get off the couch for. Time Warp, a look back on our classic and nostalgic fandoms that we still celebrate today. The End Zone, our podcast talking about all things current in the NFL and giving our best mediocre fantasy football advice. Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast. Discoville, a Star Trek Discovery and the Orville podcast. The Hair Metal podcast, if you're a hard rock music fan, the Hair Metal podcast rediscovers the nostalgia of the 1980s hair metal bands. And Type 40, a Doctor Who podcast, as we discuss all things Doctor Who, past and present. You can find these great shows on the Fandom Podcast Master Feed at fpnet.podbean.com. The Fandom Podcast Network is on iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, Google Play. On Facebook, you can find us at Fandom Podcast Network. On Instagram, we are at Fandom Podcast Network. And on Twitter, at FanPod Network. You can also email us directly at fandompodcastnetwork@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening and support the Fandom Podcast Network. And remember, respect others and enjoy your fandom.